Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody, along with Phil Latzman.
Mark, the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors meets tomorrow to discuss a touchy subject, whether to pay for upgrades that the Arizona Diamondbacks say are necessary for Chase Field.
And according to recent reports, the relationship between the team and the county over the issue has gotten contentious. The Arizona Republic reports that in a letter to Diamondbacks President Derek Hall, Maricopa County Supervisor Andy Kanasik accused the team of, quote, evolving into a parasitic enterprise, quote, selling a false narrative and doing irreparable harm to taxpayer confidence.
And to top it off, as he delivered the letter to the team, Kanasik lashed out at Diamondbacks owner Ken Kendrick, telling him, quote, take your stupid baseball team and get out. Go back to expletive West Virginia. County Supervisor Kanasik joins us now. So you don't deny that you said those things to the team, but do you regret any of it?
You know, the words I chose were, and I don't, I guess I can't even say I chose them. They just came out, and it was what I thought was a private conversation between two people dealing with what had become a difficult issue. So I never thought he'd go and you know, take down word for word things I said that somehow invaded or threatened his personal space or whatever he felt. I feel bad that I chose those words, and I wouldn't have said them in front of my kids or in pleasant company anyway. But it was in my letter that is now public as well. That really is something that I wrote it myself, and it stands on its own. It is my feelings about the whole matter, and I take it very seriously, my role as a county supervisor and as a member of the board of directors for the stadium district. And I think we've done a not just the best job we could. I think we've done a good job with maintaining that facility and carrying out the duties as the board of directors for that stadium.
Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton has said that the city is going to do all it can to keep baseball in Phoenix. That kind of brings up the idea of, since the city can offer a bond referendum and I guess the county really can't, does it make sense to entertain the idea of trying to sell the stadium to the city? Is that something that the county would discuss or could be entertained?
You know, I've always felt that the proper ownership of the stadium or the vesting of the ownership should be with a government that can see some benefit from it, the fruits of the of that asset, I guess, so to speak. But it's and Maricopa County doesn't receive bed taxes or sales taxes or, you know, all these other revenues that the city actually sees from they realize a benefit. The state realizes a benefit. Maricopa County really doesn't. So it probably was never the greatest place for the ownership to lie. I think Phoenix would do a fine job as the operator and, quite frankly, owner. And for that matter, I've been on record of being willing to just transfer it over to Phoenix. I wouldn't even be looking to get a big check or it's a taxpayer asset, and I would trust that Phoenix would be a good steward of that asset if we conveyed it to them.
Do you think this will be resolved, and do you think at the end of it, Maricopa County will still be in control of the stadium?
I will work as long as I'm there to see a happy ending for the taxpayer and the fans. And I hope it's with Major League Baseball, in downtown Phoenix for years and decades to come, not just the remainder of this term. I don't know if Maricopa County, at the end of the day, is the owner or should be the owner. because I said I think Phoenix Phoenix should be at the table, and I'm glad to hear Mayor Stanton's weighing in on this. I really appreciate his and the other members of the city council that take their roles very seriously, and I think we'll figure this out together. And I just hope the Diamondbacks are realistic and patient and helpful in this process.
Maricopa County Supervisor Andy Kunasik, hey, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
And joining us now is Arizona Republic Maricopa County government reporter Rebecca Sanders, who is covering this story. And she found out about the comments and the letters back and forth we just discussed with Supervisor Kunasik. So you heard some of that. What was your reaction?
Clearly, this is an issue where, emotions are running high for all involved. He's not seeking re-election this year. He's the only person on the board not seeking re-election, so maybe Supervisor Kunasik felt a little bit freer than others to express frustration. But I will say that, based on the feedback I've gotten, even from diehard fans, after my story ran, there's a lot of people frustrated with the Diamondbacks, saying that they need to put up money to keep the team here and be more cooperative and realize that they're making lots of money and they can, they can help out. But there's also folks who are really frustrated with the county and think that they, are being a bad landlord.
And Rebecca, what's your reaction to hearing the supervisor talk about it being a good idea if the county was to give up ownership of the team in one way or another, a transfer sale or whatever, to the city of Phoenix? And how realistic do you think something like that could it happen?
Well, this is kind of what I was asking all the different parties the past couple of days. Look, if you've got Mayor Stanton saying, bring them on, we'll take them, and then you've got, one of the supervisors saying, that sounds good to me, and then the team, has proposed it, what's stopping it? But the message I've gotten is, well, fine, but the devil's in the details. And so it sounds to me like they haven't even gotten to the table in a meaningful way to be able to discuss what would that transfer look like, what does it mean for the taxpayers, what does it mean for the investment that the county put into building that stadium and then that asset basically being transferred free and clear over to the city. There's just a lot of things that would need to be worked out, and it seems like the problem is they just haven't been able to get to that point of ironing those details out.
Rebecca Sanders covers government for the Arizona Republic. Rebecca, thanks for talking to us about this, and we'll catch up with you again in the future.
Thanks for having me.
And that was KJZZ's Phil Latsman. While the Diamondbacks, quote, respectfully declined to comment on this issue, the team did refer us to a statement from its attorney, which reads, quote, "It is unfortunate that this continues to be played out publicly by a government entity that refuses to live up to its obligations clearly laid out in their long-term agreement." The statement goes on to say the Diamondbacks are, quote, "an organization that has given so much back to the community and its fans and that has had such a tremendous impact on the economy. The county's abdication of its responsibility for necessary funding for the longevity of a public building is unprecedented and unfair to the organization and its fans," end quote. The Arizona Corporation Commission is poised to hand down a decision very soon about a small power company here in Arizona. And while that'll only affect customers in two rural counties, the case is being watched closely by many people who have a stake in Arizona's energy future. That's because this rate case is expected to have implications for the other rate cases in front of the commission. KJZZ's Will Stone has been covering this issue, and he joins me. So, Will, why do people care so much about UNS Electric?
Well, as you mentioned, Mark, UNS only serves about 90,000 customers. It's a relatively small utility, and these are customers in Mojave and Santa Cruz counties. But, you know, people are looking at this rate case and thinking of it as a harbinger for how the commission could decide on some of the critical policy decisions in the energy sector and facing many of the utilities here in Arizona. You have to remember that APS and other utilities have their rate cases going on right now, and all of these utilities are trying to revamp how they charge customers, especially those with solar panels hooked up to the grid. Hearings in this case began quite a while ago, and there was testimony from experts and lots of public hearings with many customers coming out in opposition.
Well, what was so controversial about that?
Obviously, every time you try to raise rates, no one likes that. And UNS was essentially initially proposing a rate increase that would have amounted to about $8 on the average customer's bills. And so there was a lot of public comments in opposition to that. But also they had floated a new three-part rate structure that would have included a so-called demand charge for customers.
That's something APS has talked about doing as well.
Yes, exactly. And we've already seen some major backlash from consumers about that. And essentially a demand charge is you get billed for the 1 hour when you use the most power during peak times. And so you'll have that one charge every month tacked on to your bill. And that obviously is been controversial, as well as the effort to reduce how much customers who have rooftop solar panels get reimbursed for their excess power, so-called net metering.
So, Will, what's being proposed now then?
After months of hearings, a judge issued a recommendation to the commission, and that's what they'll be considering this week. And that basically said that the rate increase shouldn't be as high as it initially was proposed. It actually should be closer to about $2 on average for the monthly bill. But significantly, the judge rejected this demand charge idea, saying it would require, you know, a massive education campaign. And basically, it's just too dramatic a change for customers in UNS. So instead, she recommended these time of use rates, where you pay a little more for electricity when more people need it, and the less when it's not peak time.
And utilities already have some of those.
Exactly. So this isn't a foreign concept. It's easier for customers to adapt to. And then for solar customers, the judge importantly said that she would like to hold off on making any real major policy decisions on rooftop solar till another proceeding in front of the commission concludes. And that proceeding is essentially the commission is trying to come up with a template, with a methodology for how to consider this issue of net metering, because it is so divisive.
So, Will, do we have any sense of how this could impact other upcoming decisions the commission will be making?
We don't really have a clear sense, but as I mentioned, obviously people see this as a bellwether as we have these other rate cases that proceed. And I did notice that in the judge's order, she did make a point of saying that even though the demand charge, she wouldn't advise that for UNS Electric, that under a different circumstance and with a different utility, it could be okay. It just depends on what the utility has done to educate customers and give them the tools to adapt. And obviously, everyone's thinking about APS when they hear that and whether this decision, you know, could impact that or not.
That's KJZZ's Will Stone. Will, thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
It's the show for Tuesday, August 9th. Glad you're here. More than half of Hispanics in the U.S. say they've experienced discrimination or been treated unfairly because of their race or ethnicity. That's what a new Pew Research Center survey found. The findings come as part of a larger study the center did on race in America, and the show's Lauren Gilger is here with more on this. And Lauren, 52% of Hispanics say they've experienced discrimination. That's a really significant number. How does it compare with some other groups?
Well, it's a much smaller percentage than you'll get when you ask African Americans. Pew found 71% of African Americans say they've experienced discrimination in the U.S., and only 30% of white people say they have. And with everything that's happening in the country right now surrounding race relations, that's not surprising. According to Mark Hugo Lopez, he's the director of Hispanic Research at Pew, and he says these numbers change over time as the national conversation changes.
Sometimes they're down, sometimes they're up. At the moment, with what's happening with all things around race relations in the U.S. and concern about race relations, we've seen a higher measured share of Hispanics who are saying that they've experienced discrimination. That may be because what's happening now may be prompting recollections of what's happened in the past. But in the past, we've seen these numbers vary some, and sometimes it's around immigration. Sometimes it's around being an immigrant. In SB 1070 in Arizona, for example, it was one example where You saw many Latinos, even U.S.-born Latinos, saying that they had been stopped by the police and asked for their papers. And that was true not only in Arizona, but around the country. And that may be, again, reflecting an awareness of what was happening back in 2010. And so people were more aware of it and were reporting that in our surveys.
When you're looking at race relations, and especially in terms of immigration in the country right now, we've got Donald Trump, presidential candidate, talking about building a wall. Do you think that's playing in, this election rhetoric is playing into what kind of responses you got this time around?
It could very well be, in addition to not only what Donald Trump has said, but also just all the attention that's been paid in the last 2 years or so to race relations between the police and the African-American community, but also just a number of incidents that have happened where people have been approached by law enforcement and something has happened in the process of being approached by law enforcement. It's not something that's unique necessarily to African-Americans. We've seen some incidences like this happen for Latinos as well, but it is something that's been more part of the national discourse in recent years than compared to, say, in the mid-2000s.
So as you look at this fast-growing population of Hispanics in the U.S., though, do you think that that the bigger this population becomes, that will affect these kinds of numbers and in terms of how discrimination is felt?
I would say it's possible, particularly because we're continuing to see a dispersion of the Hispanic population around the country to places that traditionally haven't had large Hispanic populations. So it's possible that we may see Latinos encountering more discrimination into the future. But on the other hand, it's unclear. Many of these Latinos today who are coming of age are U.S. born. They're going to school in U.S. schools. And oftentimes, many of them are the children of a Hispanic parent and a non-Hispanic parent. So how all of this might play out into the next 2 to 3 decades, I think it remains to be seen.
So you do this kind of research all the time. You've been looking at the specific population for a long time, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. Why do you think it's important that we have these numbers and that we know what the Hispanic population or any population might say about discrimination at any point in time? How does that guide us?
Discrimination may impact the confidence and also the goals that people set for themselves into the future. If you feel like you are going to be discriminated against and you can't succeed, that may limit yourself or feel limited in what opportunities may be available to you into the future. Latinos as a growing group, and particularly because it is so young, are an important part of the economic future of the country. As a result, how these young Latinos come of age, the educations they get, the type of careers they decide to pursue, how well they'll do economically is important not only for the Latino community, but also for the future.
And some other interesting findings from that study, Mark. Pew researchers found Hispanics born in the U.S. are also much more likely to say they've experienced discrimination than those who are foreign-born. And the same goes for younger Hispanics. 65% of 18 to 29-year-olds they surveyed said they'd been treated unfairly, compared to only 35% over 50.
That's interesting stuff. That's KJZZ's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you, Mark.
It's the show on 91.5. Along with The Takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Mark Brody. The Olympics, if you look at the sponsors, are a high-tech sports competition with monitoring that gets down to the nanosecond. But they're also this curious relic from ancient times with discus and javelin. Another ancient holdover in the Olympics is how it treats women. Women's events are notably shorter and fewer in number in the Olympics. For instance, Katie Ledecky's world record in the 1500-meter swim is 13 seconds faster than any other female in history. But she won't be competing in that event in Rio because she isn't a man. The longest race for female pool swimmers is 800 meters.
In the opening cycling race, the men's event was 62 miles longer than the female counterparts. Female shotgun events shoot either fewer rounds or from shorter distances. There are 3 boxing events for women and 10 for men. What's going on here? Dr. Michael Joyner is a former marathoner and resident professor at the Mayo Graduate School of Medicine.
Well, I think the good news, John, is they're a lot less discriminatory than they once were. And participation by women has increased dramatically, starting in perhaps the 1950s and 60s, but it really accelerated in the 70s and 80s.
Why are track and field events so asymmetric?
The track and field events were asymmetric, but now they're in fact quite symmetric, and really all the events contested for men are contested for women. We've seen the inclusion of the women's pole vault in the last couple of decades, the women's marathon starting in 1984. But there was this long gap from the 20s to the 60s when women weren't permitted to compete at anything longer than 400 meters. There wasn't a triple jump. There wasn't a pole vault, for example, things like that.
My daughters want to know why women aren't allowed to compete on the rings.
In gymnastics, you know, I don't know why the specifics of that are
that
in gymnastics.
That is so weird.
What the specifics are.
That's weird. Somebody knows the answer to that.
Nobody knows the answer to that is right. And it is interesting because, in general, women's gymnastics, at least from a television perspective, is much more popular than men's gymnastics.
Oh, tons more popular. That's for sure. What about swimming? The Ledecky record in the 1,500-meter swim won't be shown at the Olympics.
Right, because there won't be a 1,500 for women. The 1,500 has been contested at the World Championship since the early 2000s. And the 800 is the longest event for women in the Olympics. It's a sort of a mixed message with swimming because, in fact, swimming was ahead of track and field for a long time with races of 400 and then 800 meters for women for many, many Olympiads when longer distances didn't really start to occur for women until 1960 and especially starting in 72 and 84.
What's the holdup here? I mean, couldn't the IOC basically just say, okay, we're done with this. We'll make it symmetric.
Well, the IOC outsources a lot of decisions to the individual federations. And so I think it would have to be some sort of dialogue between FINA, the swimming federation, and the IOC. So that's the first thing that would have to happen. And then you get into these sorts of weird discussions about there's a history in the 800 so people can see a progression over time as the medal times get faster and world records are set. Versus just having the same events for men and women. If you have do you get rid of the 800 for women and just have a 1500? Do you add an 800 for men? You get into these sorts of kind of logistical, how many angels can fit on the head of a pin types of arguments. But I think the real issue here with Ledecky is here's a person who really is spectacular. And while she's good at everything, she's especially good at the 1500, and it's too bad the whole world can't see it.
You know, turn this around, it is also the case that women get the highest profile in sports in the Olympics than perhaps any other competition. I mean, World Cup may be accepted, but, you know, you don't see standout women performances with these kinds of television audiences in any other competition, right?
Yeah, I think that would be the generally accurate impression. And again, that was led by ABC's focus on gymnastics, and especially with the emergence of people like Olga Korbut, the great Soviet gymnast in 1972 at Munich.
When we've built on that, is it just in gymnastics or have other sports come along?
Gymnastics has led the way. Figure skating has been awfully popular, but other sports have really kind of ridden that wave. What we call Title IX here in the U.S., and just also the opening of more opportunities for women all over the world. So at one level, things are still bad. There's still these discrepancies. On the other hand, there are women professionals in many, many sports, and Katie Ledecky, if she chose, could take the route that Michael Phelps did and become a professional right away and really cash in. On the other hand, she's decided to go to Stanford and pursue a college career, so she has to retain her amateur status.
Yeah, I know. Having a Stanford backup, that's pretty...
Yeah, that's pretty...
she's in good shape.
And, John, that leads us to the whole issue about why can't she cash in and compete in the NCAAs while she's at Stanford. But trying to understand the NCAA is even more difficult than understanding the IOC sometimes.
Is track and field as an international sporting event with audiences outside of the Olympics, is it more or less than it has been over the course of history? I mean, is the World Cup in track and field a different animal than it was 20, 30 years ago?
People in track and field are quite concerned about interest in their sport outside of the Olympics. Some of that has been competition from other sports. Some of it has been these persistent issues associated with doping. And some of it, frankly, has been the decline of the East-West kind of Cold War rivalries. The LA Coliseum used to be filled for U.S.-Russian dual meets or U.S.-Soviet Union dual meets. That's almost impossible to imagine now.
Dr. Michael Joyner is former marathoner and resident professor at the Mayo Graduate School of Medicine. Have a happy Olympics, and thanks so much, Doctor.
Thank you.
And that's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. American Airlines recently announced it'll move its pilot training center from Phoenix to Charlotte and Fort Worth. This follows last year's move of the carrier's flight attendant training from Phoenix to Texas. It's part of American's 2013 merger with Tempe-based U.S. Airways. At the time, company executives said they plan to move the combined carrier's headquarters to American Airlines HQ in Fort Worth. Henry Hartevelt is founder of Atmosphere Research Group, a San Francisco-based travel industry research company. I asked him via Skype if the pilot training move just continues the migration of American Airlines employees from Phoenix to Texas.
Yes. I mean, I've actually gone through a couple of airline mergers in my career when I worked for the airline industry. I worked for TWA when in 1986 we merged with Ozark Airlines, which was based in St. Louis. A few years later, I was at Continental Airlines, and we merged with several different airlines. And every time we merged with the airline, we ended up consolidating the various training functions at the main facilities where we had them. And as I look at other mergers, Southwest and AirTran, Continental and United, Delta and Northwest, for the most part, the training goes to wherever the legacy carrier has its primary facility. Occasionally, some training gets left where the older airline, where the acquired airline has its facilities, and that's if they have a unique type of airplane that just doesn't make sense to bring to the new to the home office.
So, in your experience, having gone through some of these mergers, what happens to the city that basically loses the headquarters? I mean, in this case, what will happen to Phoenix as far as American is concerned?
Well, you know, I think it's important to understand that when you look at an airline, if you think of it as a triangle, the triangle is much bigger at the base with the number of workers at the airport and pilots and flight attendants and mechanics and people like that than at the top who do the management and administrative and training functions. So having been to Phoenix, having been to Tempe, where the U.S. Airways headquarters was once located, there certainly is an emotional loss to seeing an airline move out of town. But generally, the majority of the jobs, the majority of the people tend to remain because in most, though not all cases, the hub remains, and that accounts for the majority of the people who work for the airline. So yes, Phoenix and Tempe lose the prestige of having U.S. Airways headquartered there. They lose some of the jobs associated, the management, administrative, and training jobs that are there. But the bulk of the people who've been working for the airline are there. The important thing is what happens to the hub.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that as long as American doesn't remove too many flights or make any major changes at the airport, the biggest loss to Phoenix will be sort of emotional.
Correct. So, for example, I live in San Francisco, and we have Virgin America headquartered here. They just celebrated their 9th birthday yesterday. Alaska Airlines is buying Virgin America, and at some point in the next year or so, we will lose the headquarters of Virgin America. Some people will move to Seattle, and others will choose to find other careers, whether with airlines or in other industries. So we lose the prestige here in San Francisco of having an airline headquartered here, but we're going to keep the flights and may even get more as Alaska builds out the Virgin America network. So what I see for Phoenix is I think Americans generally been very, very good in keeping the Phoenix hub operating and making commitments that they will maintain that hub as long as it makes money. There's no guarantee the hub will remain the size it is. It could grow, of course. It could shrink.
Henry Hartevelt is the founder of Atmosphere Research Group, a San Francisco-based travel industry research company. For another perspective, I'm joined by Bob Mittelstadt, Dean Emeritus at ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business. And Bob, what does this pilot training mean, if anything, for Americans' relationship with Phoenix?
Well, I think it's not surprising that they would consolidate some of these support functions. And in the case of pilot training, it involves simulators, which are expensive pieces of equipment that they literally use 24 hours a day. I mean, sometimes people get scheduled in the middle of the night for their simulator sessions. With respect to what it means for Phoenix, I think Phoenix is an important and will continue to be a very important hub for America, and I don't think that it's at risk from a hub standpoint.
To you, is that sort of the key here, that the airline continue to have a major presence at Sky Harbor, whether or not it has a major presence sort of in the executive offices?
Well, even when this merger of American and U.S. Air was taking place, I predicted from the beginning that even though the executive offices were moving, that this would continue to be a strong hub. If you look at this, they have 9 hubs or so, and if you look at it by number of flights out of those hubs, Phoenix is number 6 out of the 9 in terms of the number of flights. But if you look at the number of passengers served, we're actually number 4 behind Dallas, Charlotte, and Miami. And so it's a very important hub from Americans' perspective. You have to remember that American, before the U.S. Airways merger, only had about 3 gates in the old Terminal 1 here. And when after the merger, they acquired this whole network that America West, U.S. Air had put together in the Southwest. And so you see 21, last figure I saw was something like 21 million passengers a year. That obviously that's inbound and outbound and changing planes being served through Phoenix, which is even bigger than what American considers as their biggest international hub, which is Philadelphia, where they only serve about half that number of passengers.
For a city that often laments its lack of major headquarters, does it matter for the business of this city that just sort of another piece of American is leaving?
Well, you know, the training facility, I'm sure, doesn't have that many jobs in terms of the total number of employees that you have here for U.S. Air. And you hate to see any jobs lost in Phoenix just because we're still struggling to recover from the recession. So I think that they will continue to be a strong presence here. And the reason is that this is one of the airports where they have the largest market share in their whole system. In fact, it may, well, other than maybe Dallas-Fort Worth where they, or Charlotte where they have about a 90% share. But here they've got a head-to-head battle with Southwest with 50-plus percent of the market going to American. And I just don't think they're going to walk away from that. And the reason is that a lot of that, because of the hub, it being a hub, services a lot of people coming out of Southern California from smaller airports who don't want to go to LAX to deal with all the hassle that you have to deal with there. So you have a tremendous number of feeder flights coming in from other parts of the Southwest into Phoenix. So I think it's going to continue to be an important hub.
Bob Mittelstand is Dean Emeritus at ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business.
There is one woman who's a delegate on the Navajo Nation's council, and last month she said at a council meeting that she's been sexually harassed as an elected official. Now Amber Kindesbach-Crotty is calling for change. She told the Associated Press tolerance of sexist comments at the tribe's highest level is a symptom of the larger culture on the Navajo Nation. Women in Indian country experience violence, including sexual violence, at alarming rates. And the show's Lauren Gilger is here with more on this. And Lauren, just how bad is the situation for Native women?
Well, the Federal Department of Justice reports that women in Indian country are the victims of sexual assault, rape, and violence at a rate that's more than twice that of other women in the U.S. And just in June of this year, the National Institute of Justice found that 56% of Native women have experienced sexual violence in their lifetime, 55% have experienced physical violence by an intimate partner. So I talked to Christine Thompson about all of this. She's a women's services counselor with Native Health, a healthcare provider for urban American Indians here in Phoenix, and she's a member of the Navajo Nation. And she says about 80% of the clients she works with have been victims of sexual assault or domestic violence, and about half of them before the age of 12.
Working in the trenches of where I do at Native Health, I see the aftermath, the onslaught of Native women that are coming and men that are coming from the reservation that are still dealing with the sexual assault. They come in with issues related to depression, anxiety, PTSD, They're dealing with shame, denial, guilt, and sometimes they minimize their sexual assault experience, and then they resort to unhealthy coping styles, you know, substance abuse, low poverty rates, homelessness, and it goes on.
So, Lauren, what does she think contributes to this massive problem?
Well, there are some law enforcement reasons. Most tribes haven't yet adopted the Violence Against Women Act, which they were allowed to in 2013, and that would allow them to hold non-natives accountable for some crimes against women if they can meet certain statutory requirements. And Thompson said it's a learned behavior. It's a cycle that's tough to break. And she said there's an aspect of historical trauma for Native people.
Learning a way of life that never was natural to us. And, you know, I don't want to use that as a crutch so that we can keep on abusing. But I want to say that there's a link, I would say, to the historical trauma where somewhere along the line, the natural balanced way of being respectful to people, being respectful to women, came about as being okay to violate. And then it just wildfired, stormed out of control, and now we have very sick nations right now. So it's a sad situation.
Would you describe this as a cycle in your community?
I would say that this is a cycle. The cycle does need to break. It starts with a youth level. But if you don't fix the adults that are around there that are perpetrating and help them learn that this is not the the natural, traditional way of life of our nation, we're going to have a sick cycle that's going to continue. So it's our job as clinicians, as helping professionals, to get out there and to promote awareness that sexual assault, harassment has to stop. It has to stop. Delegates, higher officials all have to pitch in to do their part.
Do you think, so you're talking about the Navajo Nation Council there, do you think that some systemic changes could help this?
The changes that need to be introduced has to be at the top level. We need to get professionals out there, survivors getting out there, talking about their issues so that we can help stop this cycle. Talking with children, telling them, hey, this is not a healthy way to live, or if anybody's hurting you or touching you, we need to work on stuff like this. It just needs to stop.
Yeah. And you do that in your work every day, it sounds like. What do you think the difference is that you can make?
I try to get to the root cause. My passion is to help Native women, Native men, anybody who's been victims of sexual assault, domestic violence, that I can help them become healthier in mind and body and spirit, to reground them, to set them on their way to closure for this traumatic experience.
Well, Christine Thompson with Native Health, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks so much.
That was the show's Lauren Gilger speaking with Christine Thompson of Native Health about the high rates of violence against women on American Indian reservations nationwide. A Phoenix-based nonprofit is partnering with ASU to test its program aimed at preventing child abuse. Child Help's curriculum will be in One Valley Elementary School this year. The group's looking for a high school district with whom to partner as well. Baina Parker is Child Help's National Director of Prevention Education. And Baina, tell me about your partnership with ASU.
Well, Child Help in general is a nonprofit. We're the oldest nonprofit in the U.S. aimed at preventing child abuse. So Child Help Speak Up, Be Safe is the curriculum that I oversee, and it's a school-based curriculum. It's pre-kindergarten through 12th grade, designed to help kids learn basic safety skills to prevent or interrupt abuse of all kinds. We've partnered with ASU as a multi-year agreement to move us from being what's called an evidence-informed curriculum to being truly evidence-based, so that we're able to say this curriculum has this impact on helping keep kids safe.
So ASU is doing the research on this,
yes,
to gather the evidence.
Yes, ASU is our research partner.
What is the advantage of having a curriculum where it's not just adults who are on the lookout for abuse and bullying behavior, but the kids themselves?
Well, it's nice because we teach the kids that they're not responsible for their own safety, that adults are responsible for keeping kids safe, so it doesn't put that burden on the children. But we teach the kids that by knowing and following certain safety rules, they're able to help those safe adults around them keep them safe. So it's kids being able to say, I've been in a situation where I feel uncomfortable, where I'm afraid of something, or I've seen something happen to other kids. Because a lot of times, the most well-intentioned adults aren't going to know and see everything that happens in a child's life. So giving kids those skills and that knowledge really helps, hopefully, prevent abuse, but stop abuse that may be happening that's well hidden.
How do you get kids to actually follow through on this? Because presumably some of the children who will be getting this instruction are the ones who are causing the behavior in the first place.
In the case of bullying, yes. In that instance, it's about really creating a culture where that behavior isn't accepted and isn't tolerated. So when this is presented in a school setting, throughout the lessons, they learn, well, okay, what constitutes bullying, what doesn't, when any time that you feel unsafe or you're not even sure if it counts, that's when you bring an adult in. So it's really helping kids understand, I don't have to decide if what's happening or what I've seen is bullying, but there is a safe adult that I can speak to who will help make that decision or take the next steps.
So what's the process of getting this program in front of kids and in front of adults and trying to gather some of that data, some of that evidence to move the program ahead?
Sure. So the curriculum itself, it's typically purchased by a school or a district, and then they can decide who their facilitators are. It could be the classroom teacher or the school counselor, social worker, somebody affiliated with the school district will come in. We train them. They come in and deliver the lessons. Through the partnership with ASU, the research team, this fall, we're having them go into a few schools here in Phoenix. They're doing some pre-test measures, some post-test measures, really working with the facilitators to get feedback, doing focus groups, so that we're able to say we have seen a certain amount of behavior change in the students, that they've retained this information, that they understand what some of these safety rules are, and that if they're faced with an unsafe situation, they know some resistance strategies that they can use.
In a perfect world, how much of a dent do you think this curriculum, once it's really implemented, can make in the nationwide problem of bullying and child abuse?
It's kind of interesting because when you work in prevention, it's hard to measure perfectly. Because ideally, you know, ideally, if you're stopping things from happening, you're not going to measure it because it didn't happen.
It's like you can't ever tell how many lives wearing seatbelts saves,
exactly.
For example.
That's exactly it. What we do know is that on average in the United States, 5 children die every day from abuse or neglect. And that number is 5 too many. So part of our mission at Child Help is to bring that number down to 0. Our goal is to get this curriculum in every school in the country and help kids learn that abuse isn't normal and it's not okay. And there's things that as a child, while they're not responsible for their safety, there are flags that they need to know if something happens, it's not their fault, that there are safe adults. And there's also the message of, you know, if something's happened and you talk to your safe adult and they don't believe you or they don't hear you, you keep talking.
Baina Parker is National Director of Prevention Education for Child Help. Baina, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Vera Mulyani calls herself a Marsketect. She has a background in architecture, urban design, and filmmaking, and is interested in ideas for building a city on Mars. Mulyani is the founder and CEO of Mars City Design, a company that plans to build prototypes of those buildings in the Mojave Desert within the next few years. It's also behind a competition soliciting designs for those buildings. Vera Mulyani joins me, and Vera, I have to ask, why Mars? Like, where did you get the idea to build a city there when we haven't even yet put a person on that planet?
Yeah, so I was just thinking about how architecture on Earth sometimes can be limited to very strict standard and rules. For me, having other planet to create the design makes us think out of the box, and hopefully that will recreate a new motivation to be more creative in our architecture today. But when I was thinking about that, actually, it was the time when Elon Musk was talking about sending humans to Mars, and hopefully by 2100, it could be 1 million people. But then I was thinking, how can we live there? How can we send 1 million people without knowing how we can, have a life, not just to survive?
So is there a part of you that is hoping that by thinking, as you said, outside the box about how to build a city on Mars, that it might make the architecture here on Earth maybe a little bit more interesting?
Yeah, so, you know, we talk a lot these days on how to heal Earth and trying to find a lot of solutions on having a self-sustainable habitat or environment. and I am all into that. And I think using an example of an extreme environment like Mars, we could definitely learn from the solutions itself. And yeah, the main goal at the end is also to use these new technologies in the design to improve our environment on Earth.
What don't we know about Mars yet that is kind of important to trying to figure out how to design a city? Like, basically, what information are you lacking to really be able to put your plan into place, besides the fact that, people have not yet visited Mars?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. You know, unfortunately, we can only work from something we know already, and we don't know much about Mars. Really, all we know is coming from what we have from the rovers and the satellites that are there. I think what's important is to know how we can survive differently, not like we know that human needs water, oxygen, and not getting radiation, and try to find out the solution for the thin atmosphere. But maybe there are things that we don't know yet how to use the material there to create new energy supply or power supply. So the answer is, I don't know what we don't know, but at the same time, I'm sure once we start something there, we can find a new way.
Do you yourself have interest in going to Mars to either work on building it or to live there?
I think the question of going to Mars is really the time we experience to get there. Once we're there, apparently, this is what Jim Erickson from NASA says, once we're there, it's very benign, but the issue is getting there. So the answer is, at the moment, no, but I am curious of, you know, if we could create a sort of first generation of robotic systems that can prepare the land first before everything else is built. Yeah, I will be so happy to go to Mars and see all these become reality, of course.
Vera Mogliani is the CEO and founder of Mars City Design and a self-described Marsgetect. Vera, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.